The Guardian. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Review Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. Our latest guest is Mark Haddon, who came in to talk about his best-selling novel, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. 10 years after it was published, it's gathering a whole new generation of fans with a stage version in London's West End. Book club maestro John Mullen pointed out that many commentators speak about this as Haddon's first book, though of course he'd already published several for young people. It was, however, his first novel to be published for both adults and children, beginning a fashion for crossover novels that has continued ever since, as Mark happily acknowledges.
It's a boring businessy thing to start with. I think one of the radical things that Random House did with the book, they realised that all the sexy young adult novels people have been writing with great sort of covers, which were dark and moody, and they thought would appeal to both adults and young adults, they all had one ISBN number on the back. And one of the things in your ISBN number, when it comes into the bookshop, it tells you which section to put it in. This was published in two identical editions, which was great, because it went to two halves of the bookshop. I thought it was an adult novel completely.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I'd written it was because I wanted to write for adults. Less so now, but certainly when that was written, everyone looked down on the writing of children's books, I think, almost universally. When you're writing for younger readers, you have to transport yourself back into what you were like at that age. I mean, you have to write for yourself. All good books, I think, are written for the ideal reader, who is yourself. But I wanted to write for the things that interested me as an adult, not the things which are inappropriate for children, which are now in all young adult novels, the sex and the violence, but things like sort of aging, death, you know, well, it's sort of your parents growing older, it's having children, those kind of things, which increasingly became a part of my life. I knew that if younger readers would read it in a different way. And one of the nice things would be, is my older son, who's 12 now, he's read it 3 times, and he said he had a different experience every time, because he realised things about Christopher's point of view. He took it sort of on face value, first of all. Then he started to see other points of view which contradicted with his, and it got more and more sophisticated. Much more interesting for me was the fact that among adult readers was a whole range of responses, from, you know, very sophisticated to surprisingly naive. One of the strange things about the book is it was bought by people who don't read books. Mm. And if you go through Amazon, it's a really interesting insight. Well, let the people who maybe read one book on the beach in the summer. So if you go through Amazon reviews, you can find out what those people expect from a book. And I think we kind of forget that. A lot of people early on wrote reviews saying, I was very disappointed because the mystery was solved halfway through the book. What was the second half for?
And presumably then, the fact that it was read by so many younger readers, children, some of them,
yeah,
was not something you'd particularly thought about. That means presumably you didn't think about the swearing too much, because there must be, for people who write for a particular age groups, I would imagine, I don't know if I'm right about this, but I'd imagine there are certain conventions which they can presumably usurp if they wish about swearing. And yet the very first dialogue, the very first conversation, yeah, in your book, somebody is using the F word, aren't they? And the swearing is quite a...
You're being careful even now, aren't you?
I am. My children are in the audience. And the swearing is quite important in it, isn't it? Because Christopher never swears. He always reports what people have said. And it's especially important because, well, as sometimes in life anyway, in the novel, certainly, people usually swear when they, you know, they're expressing emotion, yeah, of some kind. And that's exactly what he doesn't get, or he doesn't get what the emotions are. So the swearing is an important sort of
sign. In a funny,
sign,
funny kind
it?
Of way, he takes it apart, doesn't,
yes,
he? It's sort of about swearing, because swearing is meant to be offensive. And he's not at all offended by it, and he,
no,
just reports it completely,
yes,
straight. Which makes you realise, of course, it's only by ring-fencing swearing and keeping it out of certain areas that it retains that power.
Did you get any flack for that, given that one of its ISBNs put it in the children's section?
I did. I mostly got flack. Not personally got flack, but there was flack created in America. But
right,
there were two things. There was the swearing and there was the atheism. That was another interesting thing, the fact that a book could be considered offensive because of the beliefs of one of the fictional characters within the book. There were quite a few events I watched from afar on the internet where small towns in America, it's a rather good thing. They would have something called One City, One Book, or One Town, One Book event, and the librarian would choose a book, and there was a sort of town-wide book club, and lots of people would read it, and there'd be events, and they'd come together and discuss it. And they usually followed this format, that the librarian picked Curious Incident, everyone started reading it, and then a local congressman's wife would read it as well, and the congressman would see it on the coffee table, and he would read it and see that it was full of swear words, and he would complain, and he would make some big speech about it. Then what would happen was the librarian would say, have you actually read it? And then he would have to admit that he hadn't read it. It seems, on the surface, to put him at a disadvantage. If you talked about it in the abstract, you say he couldn't quite understand the connotations, the other meanings of things people say. He doesn't get the emotions people are feeling. And that sounds like a lack. But when he starts speaking, it gives him quite a lot of power. It's rather like being one of those comedians.
Yes.
Who tells jokes but refuses to laugh.
That's right, yeah.
So
yeah.
He's just sitting there watching you react, and you're somehow, if he was real, we're talking about as if he's real. If he was real, he wouldn't know what he was doing, but you're being pulled along by him. You're being somehow manipulated, and he is, in fact, in a position of great power on the page.
I mean, the humour is often dependent on his, as it were, humourlessness. But sometimes, I will punish you. I read a bit out, which I particularly like. And occasionally, he meets another character who's sort of another straight person, and then that's even funny. Do you remember he's going to buy a ticket at Swindon Station to London. This is kind of takes him a long time to do this. It's kind of a major undertaking. And he actually manages to get some money out of the cash point with his dad's car, and he goes to the window. And the man said, single or return. And I said, what does single or return mean? And he said, do you want to go one way or do you want to go and come back? And I said, I want to stay there when I get there. And he said, for how long? And I said, until I go to university. And he said, single then.
I didn't even realise it was funny when I started writing. A group of writers, we were doing an event recently, people were talking about this. Do you try to do this? Do you try to do that? What plan do you have? We were talking about short stories.
Yeah.
And I think all of us were agreeing that we do have some kind of plan, but you only feel it starts to work when something happens that is outside the plan. And all I had for that was that voice, and I just liked the voice. I didn't even think it was necessarily funny. Sometimes you find a voice and you just sink into it and you think, oh, I feel really comfortable here. And I was quite surprised how funny the book was, or how funny people thought the book was, looking back at it. Because I was inside, I couldn't see the outside of it. I often feel when I'm writing that I'm running a Punch and Judy show. And out there, people can see the story, and they can see the whacking and the crocodile and everything else. But I'm on the inside operating the sticks and the string, and it's an entirely different language. And when you hear people talking about what they can see on the other side, it's often a huge surprise.
Mm. Although my paperback edition says on the back, Christopher is 15 and has Asperger's syndrome. But of course, nothing like that, or no word like autism or anything mentioned.
I often say to people, if I could roll back time, I would take that off the cover now.
Right. Yeah. So exactly. So not having it specified is important.
Well, I like the fact that the only definition of who he is comes from him in the novel.
Yes.
When he says, "I'm a mathematician with behavioural difficulties,"
yes.
I like it. Because it's not a category that we put people into. And I always think labels tell us more about what we think about a person than that person's experience of being labelled or just being themselves. I really wanted it to be a book about difference.
Yes.
And I'm fighting a losing battle. But I try to avoid, where I can, pinning it down to one sort of interest group. I mean, obviously people who read it, I've had many people write to me and say, I have Asperger's, or my dad, my son, or whatever, and it's been a very important book for that. I don't want to undermine that at all. I think that's absolutely fantastic. But I'd just like to make that group as wide as possible. Because I've talked to many other people who would never ever get diagnosed as anything like that. And they feel that it speaks to them. And anyone to whom it could speak, I want them to be included. And I don't want a word to push those people to one side.
Well, maybe we could talk. I mean, I'd like to talk about something very striking about it. Get away from the narrator for a second and sort of talk about a bit about how the book looks. It's full of sort of diagrams, pictures.
I thought Christopher, being Christopher, would want it to look very clean on the page. He'd want the sort of absolute minimum text you needed to write those words.
Yeah.
Also, but there's a double level always going on with this book, which is that I keep saying Christopher would want this, Christopher would want that. Of course, many of those things are my own little obsessions that I don't even particularly like capital letters.
Right.
If I could have kept capital letters out of it, I would. I love the fact that then the letters will be level all the way across.
And what about the pictures? There's lots of pictures, and those are essentially Christopher's pictures, aren't they? This is written by him, isn't it?
And it's written by him in the sense that he wants... What's on the page is what he wants to be on the page. And I got sent the other day a master's thesis from a woman in Brazil. It was really interesting, and I was very touched that she sent it to me. But she was writing about graphic representation on the page. And she pointed out some things I'd never really thought of before. First of all, that they're not illustrations. You very rarely look at a book where the fictional creator of the book has actually made their own marks on the page, diagrams to help you with it, as if it was his notebook, which had been taken to a typesetter and tidied up.
Yeah.
And I think it looks doubly like that because, do you remember Word used to come bundled with a little painting program? It's called Paint. It was very pixely. They're all bitmap files. You couldn't do anything particularly smooth. I had wasted so much time when I was avoiding writing learning how to draw really quite well just using a mouse. It's bloody difficult. But my wife used to say to me, what use is that skill? Because I produce our Christmas cards using this little program. And then I put the pictures in here.
How many of these pictures?
I earned quite a lot of money with my useless skill in the end. So I did all of the pictures, yeah.
Well, even the Bakerloo lines.
But it was nice. It was a feeling of getting... When I was being Christopher and then I'd move from writing to drawing... In fact, when you're on a computer, it's very easy to get into a kind of Christopher-y state of mind. I don't know to whom it happens here. Especially if I'm doing something graphic on the computer. I do a lot of art, and I do some of it on the computer. I can completely go down the rabbit hole. You know, you come up a couple of hours later, and you can't quite remember what time it is or where you are.
Computer.
A lot of people ask how much research I did into Asperger's and autism, and I confess that I did none, but I did a lot of research into train stations. I went to Swindon train station. I still got the photographs.
Yeah, no, I was wondering about whether you... Yes.
It's all very authentic, the maps of the station. And in fact, if you look at... Paddington's probably changed quite a bit now, but if you take that page and you go to Paddington, you can find most of those things still there. If you look closer, you can probably find the bits of graffiti as well. I'd probably be arrested now for standing around in a mainline train station taking as many photographs as I took.
Well...
On the tube as well. Again, it was getting Christopher right, but it was also getting in his state of mind. So I'd be on the tube, I'd be taking little photographs of the pattern you get on the seats.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny you say that, because I think Metropolitan Police have a bit of a job discerning who's behaving strangely and who's a novelist, because... You are not the first person to have sat, as it were, in that chair and said that. I mean, certainly a few years ago now, I was asking Ruth Rendell about a novel she'd written, a murder novel, of course, set in London. And I said, I imagine you being, although she gave fictional names to it, but it was set in suburban North London. I said, I imagine you go to a place and sort of... And she said, I do. I take a camera. I walk around. I make notes. So, I mean, I have kind of this vision at various bits of London, of sort of British towns and cities. There are probably all sorts of writers walking around with cameras and notepads. You're not the only one.
In fact, so underneath almost everything I write has to be a kind of map, and partly because of who I am, and I think partly because my father was an architect. If a novel is set in a house... Before I do anything, I have to know how all the rooms connect. I'm sure other writers have ideas of character or their history and everything else, but once I've got the floor plan right, I feel sort of comfortable. That's the basis of the world, and then I can start moving people around.
When you invented Christopher, when you had the idea, it does seem he asks you to take quite literally things which other novels just sort of expect you to take for granted. So, for instance, he says, I'm thinking about people talking.
Yeah.
He says, I'm really good at remembering people's conversations. And that's why I'll get the word slightly wrong, but he says, that's why all the conversations in this book are completely reliable, because I remember people's conversations.
Yeah. All novels are like, I think of them as a vase, say, and they're fired and they have great patterns on them and they have this very smooth pattern all over, but there always has to be some bit which sort of rested on the kiln floor. There always has to be a bit that's got no glaze on it. And different novels have it in different places, because novels aren't true. But they have to seem true. So there is, if you poke around somewhere, you can find that place that's got no glaze on it. And different novels have them in different places, and it's where you have to. It's where you have to locate your blind spot if you're going to believe it. And of course, the blind spot of this is it's so big, you just take it for granted that you put it out of the way that he's writing a novel for you.
Yes.
That the person who cannot communicate is actually written this novel, which has sort of, it ended up in so many hands.
Yes.
And also, although it seems very naive, I hope it's structured very, very carefully to give you a novelistic experience, which is, of course, the last thing in the world that he will be able to do, because that does need some sense of not just a reader, but more specifically, you being the writer and then putting the reader's hat on, sort of moving around to the other side and picking it up and thinking, how would I react? Which is almost by definition the single thing that he can't do. Mm. It sort of glories in the fact that it is a novel. On the one hand, you switch off and you read it, but it's all the time, it's drawing you back to the way in which it's written and the fact that it is a physical book, the fact that there are diagrams on the page, the fact that, quite oddly, the physical book also makes an appearance in the book.
Yes, yes. Well, I was going to ask you about that, because, of course, you do what any self-respecting 18th-century novelist would do, which is to make the physical thing part of the story. So his dad confiscates it, as it were, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And then whilst he's looking for it, he goes through his father's cupboards and he finds all those letters from his mother. So the book has been used to direct him to something which is very, very important in the
plot. One thing that's really interesting, I think you probably know that it's on in the West End at the moment, and it's adapted by Simon Stevens rather brilliantly. When we were watching it, we realised that the emotional centre of the book and the play are just very slightly different. Mm. Because it has to move, it's a radically first-person book, obviously. You only know about other people mediated through his quite odd and interesting mind. So the emotional centre of the book is finding the letters, obviously. On stage, you have to move it into the third person, and the emotional centre of the play becomes his father reading the book.
Right.
Because you realise that is the point. That is the point at which the whole relationship changes.
Yes.
In the book, it's just the knowledge changes. But you know, when his father reads the book, then it's all going to go wrong.
Yes. I've got more questions, but it's time I gave everybody else in the room a chance.
What kind of advice would you give to someone who wants to write a novel but has trouble taking it from the planning stage to the writing stage?
In the green room at the Queen Elizabeth Hall, we were talking amongst ourselves, these writers, about various things, including their working day and how much work they put in. And I realised I was the only person in the room who really hated the process and spent weeks on end unable to do anything. So I was talking to Rupert Thompson or Rose Tremaine, and they say, when I get a good day, I'll sit down for 8 hours. I think, shit. I would so love to be able to do that. You need to go and ask Rose Tremaine. It's the first answer to the question. Just do it, even if it's bad. I think this is true of lots of people. It's certainly true of me. I don't think I'm a very good writer, but I'm a really good rewriter. And I just have to hold my breath and just write something that's really crap. And as long as I get enough of it down, I can throw some bits away, you can go through, you can pick the good bits out. And every day when I sit down, I'm writing something along, I'll get a sort of comb out and I'll go through it and I'll make it hopefully better and better and smoother. Curious, I would say the first few chapters have probably been edited 50, 60, 70 times. I mean, only just going through once. Mm. But every time, every pass, I'd have changed a little thing. After we'd sold the novel, I had to then go back and had to put the same effort into the last few chapters, because I could certainly see there was a little raggedness at the end. Mm. So, you know, just do it, and then remember that editing is really important.
I was wondering, where do you actually get your characters from? Where are they you in different guises, or are they characters that come from reality?
Actually, the one person who does contain bits lifted from other people is, in fact, Christopher. because I wanted to take sort of little modules, as it were, of behaviour and put them together, and they were all things taken from people I know who would never have any kind of label of disability. So that, you know, not having food touching, the obsession with red cars. I know people who have these things. Obsession. I know quite a few people who have obsession with numbers. I do know someone who adds up the date and has a system for deciding whether it's a good day or a bad day. And there's certain things they won't do on a bad day. And I like the fact that Christopher is, in a way, composed of some behaviours and ideas, none of which would really cause anyone a problem in interacting with people in daily life. And it's the combination of those things that makes his life quite difficult sometimes. And I also think that's why people feel they can relate to him, not because he's different, because they share lots of those things.
I'm going to ask a strange question. I don't know if it makes any sense. Does Christopher know that it's been published?
No, so it makes perfect sense. I mean, in fact, it's a very good demonstration of what we were saying earlier, wasn't it? That he has this larger life that is not normally gifted to many characters in novels. He can't, because I think that's the unglazed bit of the pot, isn't it?
Yes.
That's where we have to suspend our disbelief. We almost have to forget that it's a published novel.
Yeah.
That's what we have to do. We have to pretend we're picking up that book that his father dropped in the bin.
I just wonder how much time you have for your art. I didn't see the original, but I saw a reproduction from the Bankside Gallery, Portrait of Stu, which I thought was fantastic.
Thank you.
I wonder how that's all going.
I'm doing quite a lot at the moment, which means, in other words, I'm having trouble writing. I'm actually very glad of it. I think for a lot of writers who write just novels, they stop and they have to have a week off, and then you have to do the same thing again. As I was saying, I have trouble writing, so I can paint. And I've started to actually do portraits, and particularly portraits of writers, which gets me out of the house, enables me to sit and talk to writers I like who maybe I haven't met before.
You write to them and say, I want to paint a
picture. Yeah. I've just finished one of Simon Armitage. It's fascinating. I do it from photographs. I take too long to make someone sit down. Because I'm not a real painter, I can't make someone sit down for 2 weeks. So I'll take about 500 photographs of people and often paste them together to try and find that face that someone has that just relaxes. There's a face people have. It just looks right. They just look settled in themselves. I was taking photographs of Jackie Kay. I mean, her face moves all the time. She's always talking and smiling. She's very dynamic. And I got about two photographs out of 500 that are going to work for her. Simon Armitage only does one face.
It's true.
I was taking some photographs of him, and I said, Simon, it's like photographing a lizard. And he said, that's because I'm a grumpy bastard.
Yeah, it's called Yorkshire, I think. Yeah.
I know you mentioned that it wasn't really your intention to target an audience of people who had an interest in autism or a link in some way, but to what extent would you agree that the novel has contributed to a perception of autistic spectrum disorders, especially given that now that there's a West End adaptation?
I'm very chary of putting any kind of expert hat on and pretending that I can speak for people with the disorders or in organisations who work with people those in that state. So I won't. But what I know has changed is that there are many books out there on the subject now, and it features in many novels, and I know that because I'm sent every single one. But it's interesting what you said about Curious in the West End. It's not flagged up at all, is it? Mm. When the play is written about, if you see the publicity, I love the fact that it's sort of opened out. It's Christopher is at the centre of this kind of theatrical experience, and it's in no sense is it about disability. And I think I was in the article in The Guardian, I was saying it's become quite important to me. It was important in the novel, and I think this is even more evident on stage, that what gets labelled, and this is another reason for not labelling him, because it's called a disability, which makes it a negative thing, makes it something about a lack. The way he sees the world opens vistas to him which most of the rest of us simply do not see. I mean, he can look into space and see things that we just don't see. In fact, I'm talking about space and mathematics. Those are the obvious ones. But he says at one point in the book. He's talking about why he hates France, and he hates going on holidays. And he says, I think there's more than enough things in one house to keep you interested for a whole lifetime. And I think that's not a disability, is it? Yeah. Let's not call that a disability. That's something to be celebrated.
My question is, did you sit in on the early rehearsals, and did you have to do any additional writing or rewrites to fit in with the genre of the theatre?
If you're a writer, particularly of a novel, and you hand it over to a film company or for someone to adapt for stage, I think the only thing to do, the most important decision is get the right people to do it. If you get the right people to do it, you don't have to do anything else at all. If you get the wrong people to do it, and I think, let's not mention names, we know writers this has happened to, you'll lose 2 years of your life trying to steer the almost right people in the direction that you wanted them to go. We had many, many requests for stage rights, two for a musical. The producers of Godspell actually said, could they do a musical of it? Well, I just thought it wouldn't work. I thought it's ridiculous. How can you turn something that first person into something that third person? But eventually, we had so many requests, I thought, let's just go and find the people who can do it. I love Simon Stevens' writing. Also, I don't know whether you know his work, he always writes about bleak nihilism and random violence. And I thought, if there's anyone who'll avoid sentimentality, it's him. I think at the end of the play, he'd prefer to have Christopher bludgeoned with a rock. But I, but I love his voice. And the other thing that is rather brilliant about him is that... I'll say one thing about the play, it's not giving away too much. Yeah. There's dance in it. Simon's brilliance wasn't just adapting the words on the paper. He sat down and he read the book and he said, in fact, I'm quoting him, he said, I realise that Christoph has this balletic mind, really sort of mobile. He dances in his head. Let's do the dancing on stage. It sounds ridiculous. You go to see the play and you think, obvious. But I think it took Simon to realise that.
I thought the production was brilliant at the National, absolutely. And I wonder what you thought of Luke Treadaway's performance, not as a technical performance, but I thought it was really interesting what you said in the programme, that Christopher's never described in the book, and then he came on the stage and everybody went, that's Christopher. And it was the most brilliantly technical performance as well. I just wondered what you thought of that and if you felt it captured something you hadn't really knew existed.
He is brilliant. We all thought he was brilliant. And I think we all secretly thought, would it hold up if he wasn't doing it? But it's a very tough physical role, and he's got like sort of 7 or 8 performances a week. So in fact, on Monday and Tuesday, Christopher's played by a rather brilliant young actor called Johnny Gibbon. And he's fantastic, but he's different. He's physically bigger, he's much stronger. He doesn't have that kind of... I mean, Luke's extremely lithe, and he's very poetic in all his tiny movements. Even things when he's not... There's a lot of hectic movement in the play, and he's great at that. But even when he's just having his sort of shirt taken off, it's just a joy to watch, because he's very conscious of all of his body, and it's lovely. And John is not like that. He's sort of a bit rougher. But there's a kind of... He's different psychologically. He has that same kind of attention to detail in the things he's saying. A, that's great because he's great, and the people who go on Monday and Tuesday are not being cheated of anything whatsoever. But I think it's another demonstration of the fact that Christopher is this space into which people can step. And it also bodes really well for the play carrying on.
Thank you all very much for coming and for your questions. And I'm sure we all want to thank Mark for coming and talking to us.
Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.